There was a fire in Chicago in 1871. A huge fire. There had been a drought. Most buildings were made of wood. Sidewalks were even made of wood. Sawdust was frequently used to damp down dust in the city at the time. The fire spread rapidly and burned for 2 days. The hot, dry, and windy conditions made it easy for flames to jump and move through the entire city. I think we have an image, yes. Known as the Great Chicago Fire, the blaze destroyed a third of the city. 300 people died, 100,000 were left without homes, a whole community of people disoriented and destabilized. And in the days following, in the midst of this chaos and turbulence, a reporter for the Chicago Republican claimed that he knew who was responsible. He knew whose fault all of this was. So I think we have an image of the villain of this story. Yes. Catherine O'Leary and her cow. As you can sort of see from the caption on the bottom, supposed cause of the Chicago fire, Mrs. O'Leary and her cow. I appreciate how this illustration almost looks like the cow is intentionally kicking right there as she watches. O'Leary testified that she had been in bed when the fire started. But soon more images like this one from Harper's Magazine began to appear throughout the city. Then came the stories that she was drunk, followed by claims that she had obviously hidden the evidence of her guilt. Catherine O'Leary was an Irish immigrant. And the widespread anti-immigrant, anti-Irish sentiments in Chicago at the time made Catherine and her family easy targets for blame. The emotional system looked for a scapegoat, someone or something, to take the blame, likely even before the final flames died down. You can probably take this image off the screen now, unless you want it with us. Thank you. As humans, we do this in big and small ways, right? Blame within our families, with a group of friends, work, community, and as larger bodies, as cities, as countries, as cultures. When things go wrong, blame quickly discharges feelings of discomfort, uncertainty, out onto something or someone else. Blame can also discharge feelings of fear or helplessness. Like in the story of Trayvon Martin, a more contemporary example, a 17-year-old high school student, young and black, who was shot and killed in a gated community in Florida a few years ago, and who was quickly blamed for his own death. It was his fault he was shot. He was the one wearing a sweatshirt with a hood. Trayvon Martin, as we know, was unarmed. He was walking back to his dad's fiance's house with his hand in his pocket, holding on to the Skittles he had just purchased at the store. Because we live in a dominant culture that has this pattern of blaming people of color for the violence that they experience, often as a way of avoiding responsibility, victim blaming in the case of Trayvon Martin and so many others was quickly adopted on a wider scale. Victim blaming can often be subtle and almost unconscious, and it shares a similar root to the ways blame shows up across the board, because blame shows up in the smallest of moments, although with much smaller consequences the ways we practice blame in our day-to-day lives makes it much easier for us to then be caught by these larger narratives of blame when they do show up. It's almost like a muscle. Blame points the finger. Blame is fast. It's reactive. It's someone else's fault. It's you, other, them. Anything but me and my responsibility. As a small example, in my own life, blame seems to be a steady companion at least once a week when I am sliding into a meeting 5 minutes late, which I do a lot. It's a growing edge of mine. So as the frustration begins to rise when I can't believe that I'm 5 minutes late again to the same meeting, almost instantly I think, it's my partner Andy's fault if she hadn't parked behind me in the driveway this morning. Or my housemate's fault if only he hadn't told me every ingredient in his smoothie this morning. Depending upon how much time I have between the parking lot and the building of the meeting I'm late to, I could have blamed traffic, or a train, or that one driver in front of me who was going the speed limit. Many of us instinctually find a scapegoat, even in these small ways, someone or something to be a depository for my own discomfort, for our own discomfort that bad things happen to good people. Discomfort in our own imperfections. Discomfort when we feel out of control, uncertain, or helpless. Blame is the easy fix when things go wrong. But the truth appears to be much more beautifully complex than what blame can capture. The true source of the Great Chicago Fire was never known. The fire did originate from the O'Leary property, but was likely started by something as mundane as a spark blown down a chimney on a windy night. The reporter who started the rumor about Catherine O'Leary and her cow eventually, 20 years later, confessed that he had lied. But by that time, it was almost too late. Real damage had been done to Catherine O'Leary and her family. This simplified story of fault was so appealing, it's so attractive, that as many of you might know, it's been canonized through camp songs and legend for 150 years. In our worship series right now, Sinners and Saints, we're exploring the ways we can get caught in the binary, in the false idea that there are good people and then there are bad people, and that life is always fair and clear. Our liberal religious lineage has been complicating this binary for centuries. Grown out of witness that we are capable of both loving each other and harming each other. Grown out of witness that we can, that when we come together in relationship, whether with our spouse or within our families, at work or at church, it's not a matter of if we will harm each other, but when. Some of our liberal religious ancestors also recognized that this isn't actually bad news. It's just what is. And it's not the end of the story, because it's also within the shape of relationship that we have the capacity for love, for generosity, for caretaking, for justice. The founders of our free faith, this faith where there is no creed that holds us together, there's no statement that you must believe, these founders named something else as crucial, something essential that makes space for the generosity and the love exchange, but without being naive to the harm. Something needed in order to be in relationship with one another for the long haul. in order to live lives alongside each other in both times of ease and conflict, in order to end a relationship if needed, in order to try to do good work with each other for something larger than ourselves. It was promises, spoken commitments, spoken agreements, covenant. In 1637, some of our religious ancestors were 30 families who emigrated to what is now the United States in an attempt to escape persecution from the Church of England. They met frequently in Massachusetts, trying to figure out how they were going to live life with each other. They decided that the members of this new free community would not be governed by a king or a bishop, that they would decide their own rules, but that they would be joined by covenant, by promises to each other, to something larger than themselves, and to other communities like their own. Here in this congregation, we affirm our covenant as we just did moments ago, each and every Sunday, recommitting again and again each time we say the words out loud for ourselves and for each other. We also have a covenant of right relations, adopted by Foothills members, many of you, in 2015. It's very specific, and we're going to share it out this week in our communicator, so look for that. But as a teaser, it includes commitments to communicate directly, honestly, and compassionately, especially in conflict, to not expect to always get your way. It begins with, we covenant to build a religious community guided by love and sustained by respectful relationships. But many of us have or will make commitments in different parts of our lives. This sense of a promise might be more relevant for you in the sense of your marriage with your spouse. Making promises to each other, speaking vows that are witnessed about who you will consciously, intentionally, with effort, try to be in the relationship. In the five major ingredients of covenant, Unitarian theologian and minister James Luther Adams says this: human beings, individually and collectively, become human by making commitment, by making promise. He continues, the human being as such, as Martin Buber says, is the promise making, the promise keeping, the promise breaking, the promise renewing creature. The human being is the promise maker, says Adams, the commitment maker. In other words, it is through the practice of making commitments to each other, speaking them to each other in relationship over and over again, that we learn and shift and grow, that we become more human. Denying that we have the capacity to harm each other, and likely will, actually causes more harm. It's by creating space for all that moves between us that real relationship becomes possible. In the story of blame, only one side really gets a voice. In the story of commitments, of covenant, that are of spoken commitments that are returned to and held in mutual accountability, more than one side of the story can be expressed. And then a third thing grows out of the sharing that can then be glimpsed. Blame collapses the space between you and the other. Covenant, promises, like tent stakes, provide an anchor so that more space can be experienced, so that more of the mystery that moves between you and all life can be known. Blame is fast and reactive. Living in intentional relationship is super slow. And it requires us to trust the space between, to not be afraid of the gap between yourself and another, to share your experience and your side of the story, and then to leave enough silence and room for another perspective to share theirs, trusting that there is sacredness in all that moves between us, in all of its complication, messiness, rawness, realness, just as described in our poem this morning. We're getting Michelangelo all wrong, writes Glenn Thomas right out. God is not the bearded one surrounded by angels floating over the Sistine. He is not Adam with his muscled back pressing the earth. No. God is the closing inch of space between their reaching fingers. God is waiting in the space between fingers that might connect. Whether the word God makes you feel curious and engaged or shuts you down in an instant, please replace the word if you need to love, to spirit of life. I invite you to still hear the message that travels underneath those words, that holds the movement in between. The way flowers speak to bees without a word, that wades in the contradiction of songs from slave shacks, that swims in your tears when you finally look in the mirror and really love yourself, that flows from the turning leaves and the embrace of fall. There is so much more to the story of all that moves between us, perhaps more than we can ever fully know. We can't control it or make certain what is uncertain, but we can experience it. We can live and love. We can forgive and be forgiven or choose not to. We can sing and learn and grow. We can trust. We can surrender. Yes, it's risky, but it's so worth it. Amen.